Hello and welcome to The Double Pivot, the world's most agreeable soccer analytics podcast. I am Michael Cayley. We are heading into an international break, but we got sent off into the international break with some great football. So, I don't know, great football will return after a couple weeks. But until then, we will be talking about some of the football. And we also, there is a sort of this like a two-part podcast. Big news in the NWSL, and it's also sort of like ended up becoming more of a global story in women's sports as well. We wanted to touch on that and some of the real, like, structural changes that seem to be possibly partly uncertainly in process in the NWSL and elsewhere. So, two-part podcast coming up. I'm joined by Mike Goodman. Ready to talk about different stuff?
Let's do it. The music you heard on the way is the Whalers. We've got this podcast. We've got a podcast on the patreon.com/doublepivotside where we will be doing stat and narrative stuff, sort of like looking at the first chunk of the season and sort of like signals and noise and conflicting signals and figuring all that stuff out. Let's start with NWSL before we get into like the actual soccer stuff. So I imagine most of our listeners have been following the news, but basically the immediate precipitating incident was our friend Meg's reporting on Paul Riley, who was the manager in North Carolina, being I believe the term that they used in the reporting was sexual coercion of a player. And the really problematic thing was that he had been hired several times in the league, and this was not unknown about him while he was going through that process. There had been investigations that cleared him of technical wrongdoing before, or if they didn't clear him, still allowed him to resign without a public admission of having done anything wrong. And while that was the precipitating incident, and it's a big one, it's led to the resignation of the commissioner of NWSL, it led to the cancellation of games last weekend, it was notable that it was like the fourth manager this season who has left their job under various levels of wrongdoing. This is not the same thing as a manager who is insulting about a player's physical appearance, but a manager was fired for being insulting about a player's physical appearance. And again, it was not publicly known at the time that was what was going on. Then you have Richie Burke in Washington, D.C., who was fired for being abused, verbally and emotionally abusive towards players. Like, there have been just a piling up of these this season in NWSL. That has led to this becoming a major breakthrough story at this point. It's one of those moments where you're seeing stories about this confluence of events in NWSL from places that don't ever cover the soccer matches of the league, which is its problem in its own right. I think we don't necessarily think we have specifics to add to the reporting, to the specifics of the, like, you're just not, one of the things that I said on Twitter recently is just like the level of talent covering NWSL right now is off the charts, especially considering the size of the league. The reporting has been phenomenal across the board, in sort of a whole bunch of different mediums. But I do think that this, like, gets to some of the kinds of structural issues about, sports ownership and sports leagues and how these things exist in the world that we talk about a lot on this podcast. So I think we wanted to sort of talk about those things on this podcast.
Yeah, so we'll throw some of the links to some of the really, again, just fantastic, exemplary reporting that's been done. Meg Linehan, clearly, but I would also mention Molly Hensley Clancy and Steph Young as having done really fantastic work advancing this story and telling these stories it is so important that you tell the story in a way that respects and honors the person who is telling you this story and the risks that they are taking to speak out. And I think that they've all done that really, really well. It's been, you know, as hard as this story is and as sad and maddening as this story is, the quality of their reporting really stands out, and the bravery of the players speaking out really stands out as something to honor. Yeah, the thing that I have thought about as this has been going on, and this is something that is, you know, I think that Meg in particular has really highlighted this brilliantly in her stories, is the degree to which that this is a labor story and a business story. Like, it is downstream of, like, you know, misogyny and patriarchy and the ways that that men abuse women, and, you know, that this is a cultural problem. But it's also downstream of the fact that the NWSL is trying to start a league on a shoestring. And so players have... A large number of NWSL players are not being paid a living wage. Almost none of them have anything even resembling job security. There's a lot of people who need second jobs. Even the people who don't have second jobs, like, you know, they could get cut, and then they would. And this puts players at a just massive disadvantage in terms of power and ability to speak out. And then at the same time, there is, I think, the other part of this that's really important is that, and again, I'm just really pulling this from Meg's writing, but is that women's sports leagues, women's soccer leagues in particular, have failed in America before. And there is a deep and, I think, abiding and correct belief, a belief I share, that it is clear that the market is there, the audience is there, the consumers are there to make this a successful enterprise over time at a quite significant scale that makes people lots of money and makes fans happy and all of these sorts of things. But it takes time to build it. And every time a league fails, it takes that much more time to start building it up. And so so this league, which is structurally exploitive of labor without even getting into the gendered aspects of it, is also, you know, propped up by this general belief, and I think, like, correct belief, that it is this league that kind of has to succeed if we're going to get to the level of success for women's soccer in America as a professional entity that we'd like to see in the next 5 years. And those combine to create an opportunity for this kind of abuse to go unchallenged. And I don't know what to do with that. I think it's just, like, those are the structures that help enable this.
Yeah, I think there are a couple of things here that I want to add to that. And one is just that, like, this idea that there's a market for women's sports is, I think, 100% true. The underlying backstory here is that there are a lot of people who really want NWSL to succeed and women's sports to succeed. And what that leads to, or has led to for a long time, is there is this protectiveness of the league and of its need to exist and of its need to do well, you know, from fans, from supporters of women's sports who want there to be women's sports in the world. That is a different relationship than sort of the broader fandom's relationship with the leagues that exist, right? It's a little, you can make some comparisons to American soccer culture, wanting soccer to succeed and become a sport in America in some ways, but, like, NFL fans are not looking at the NFL being like, we need the NFL to succeed or else, right? Like, that, like, you can, NFL fans get to accept the existence of their league as fact. And so when you don't get to accept the existence of the league that contains the sport that you want to root for as fact, it changes the player league, the fan league relationship. There has been for years this, like, whether or not leadership of NWSL deserved it, this feeling from fans that, like, this is the only game we got in town and we need it to succeed. So that's part of it. A second part of it is there has been a bifurcated relationship of labor versus ownership in women's sports, in women's soccer specifically. Because of the fact that every women's soccer league, in the NWSL is no exception in the United States, has been founded on the backs of the popularity of the U.S. women's national team. And those women are genuine stars. They are revenue-driving stars. They are media-driving stars. They know, and the league knows, that the league cannot exist without them. On the other hand, the rest of the players, and although that pool of players has NWSL has continued to be successful, has expanded beyond just what was, you know, maybe 7 or 10 players to 30 or 40 players, really, at this point. The rest of the players are even more at the mercy of ownership than you would, than they would be in a different sport. And then finally, you have, like, what is NWSL as a league and what is NWSL ownership? Like, what are they trying to get out of team ownership here? Is it the same thing that, like, owners of sports in you know, more traditional male leagues that an NBA owner or a Major League Baseball owner wants to get out of owning a team? Like, is it a business decision where they want to buy what they think is a, you know, an undervalued asset that as this league grows and expands will become more valued? You know, and what do they view as the way in which NWSL grows and becomes more valuable to them? And I really do think that, like, because of the general steer, you know, pulling in one directionness of it all, the ownership structures of NWSL have gotten a lot of, I don't want to say passes. I don't think that, like, they've been, like, allowed to skate on bad behavior. I just think there's been a lack of real analysis about, you know, how these things interact. But as NWSL grows, and it's undeniably growing over the past few years, these things are going to come in conflict with one another. And they are going to come in conflict in real and sustained ways. And while the last week's stories deserve a lot of attention in their own right and should primarily be viewed as stories in their own right, they are also a precipitating incident for all of these forces that have been loosely and more or less bound pulling in the same direction that are starting to come into much more open conflict as NWSL tries to grow and become a bigger entity. And I don't think any of us really know how that story ends, but that is absolutely what is playing out sort of in the wake of this precipitating incident.
I think we will leave it there. I think that, to me, I am just, like, rooting for this league to succeed, you know, to protect players, and which are also the change that needs to get the league growing and to make these next steps into growth as a larger business entity, which it needs and can do. But, you know, these are the crises that happen as you are growing, and then these crises are, you know, of particular sort of moral concern because these crises intersect with issues of misogyny and patriarchy and the abuse of power that we're seeing from a certain set of male coaches. So that's the story. We're going to keep following it. May have some people on to talk about it, but we wanted to talk about it here and sort of place it in that context. So now we will just change gears, talk about Liverpool and City.
Yeah, let's talk about Manchester City and Liverpool, which was like a freaking great soccer match, and we like great soccer matches. I was going to say, I think there are two sort of notable things to the match. One that you see before the match and one you see at halftime, right? So before the match, you see Jack Grealish starting as a false nine, which he has not yet done for City, which I think, like, makes everybody raise some eyebrows. Is Guardiola doing his big match thing again? You know, is he going to overthink it? Like, what's the deal? And then I mean, they kind of dominate the first half, but don't score. And then we see a major change at halftime, not in, like, personnel or formation or lineup, but in Liverpool changing to some degree the way they are playing and thus play much better. Like, to me, those are the two things that happen. You see Jack Grealish start as a false nine for City, which has mediocre returns despite the fact that City really dominates the first half of this match. And then you see Liverpool, you know, make a really clear tactical change at halftime to get themselves back in the match. Although, it, like, the irony being, like, it's fairly incidental to the goals. But, like, you know, this is one of those games which was a very, like, interesting high-level match. But also in which the goals were not necessarily derived from that. So,
yeah.
Were those the things you would have picked out as well?
Yeah, exactly. And like, you know, I think it's interesting because it's not exactly like before the match. You know, before the match, I saw the lineup. I was like, oh, Foden's playing as his sort of nine quasi false nine, and Grealish and Jesus are the wingers, and like that. But then they get out of the pitch, and very clearly, Foden is targeting Milner, and Foden and the attack worked by running everything through Cancelo and Foden. And, you know, it was, you know, Milner was unable to deal defensively, and City and Liverpool had to do a ton of defending in and around the penalty area. Their center backs had a fantastic game, and they were able to prevent City from creating any really great chances. But, like, that was the target of the attack. And I think that, like, one of the reasons that they succeeded, that City were able to, that Liverpool succeeded in not conceding hardly any great chances. You know, they only conceded, you know, seven shots from all of those plays around the penalty area, was in part that Grealish, like, doesn't follow those central runs through. That's not his game. It is, you know, we spent a podcast talking about, like, Ferran Torres is just, like, a good striker. And it was very notable watching Grealish that he didn't do those things that Ferran Torres was like, oh, okay, I guess I was a winger, now I do these things and I make that run for the cutback. Grealish wasn't there for those cutbacks.
Yeah,
and that was a real sort of weakness in this approach.
I do sort of wonder whether, like, the platonic version of this game plan was that Grealish was supposed to need to come over and combine to, like, break through on the right when added help came, and that you were then supposed to have, like, Raheem Sterling arriving in the box to finish moves. But it, like... like, Liverpool, to their credit, I guess, I don't even really know, like, didn't really get sucked over to the wing in that way as they attempted to deal with Cancelo and Foden, and just sort of were like, we will be, at least in the first half, content losing that battle and defending the middle of the box. And it... I'm not going to say it didn't work. I think the reason why I would say that City dominated the first half is that on the other side of the ball, Liverpool created nothing in the first half, right? And in some instances, in some matches, I will look at the attack and say, okay, that lack of attack is like a carry-on effect from getting beat at the defensive side. I didn't really get that sense in the first half. I mean, I got the sense a lot that, like, Liverpool basically by the skin of their teeth dealt with, you know, their sort of faulty right side, were able to turn over possession, get the ball, try to move up the field and create chances, and were just totally unable to in that first half.
Yeah, like, it's worth noting that, like, the possession split is only 55-45 in this half. Liverpool right. had a lot of the ball and did basically nothing with it.
Yeah, you know, I talk about this a deal on the podcast, but I've never, like, talked about this. We too often, like, look at who won versus who lost the possession battle as a binary thing. Like, the difference between 53-47 and, like, 58-42 is massive when you think about it in those terms. And so, like, you know, you can get away with things at 57% possession that you can't at 53. You can on the flip side, as an attacking side, have deficiencies that don't bother you at 52 that rear their ugly head at 45. In general, Liverpool were just not able to get into an attacking rhythm in the first half. And, like, it's a problem if, like, the problem is that you don't have enough possession when you have 45 against City. Like, that's the thing, is that City is going to have a lot of possession almost all the time. So you, the things that you want to do, you have to be able to do at 45, 47% of the ball. Now, if you're down at like 42, 43, you can say, okay, we didn't have enough possession. But at like 45, you should be you should have enough of the ball against City to game plan to do what you want. And they just didn't in that half.
Yeah. And I think that, like, you know, there's you know, couple of things going on here. One is, you know, having Curtis Jones in on the left and then playing Jordan Henderson on the right, you are then giving Jordan Henderson this job where he has to be everywhere and knitting together Milner and Salah and protecting that area. And he can't do that anymore. He has developed into a quite good six, but he can't do that, like, you know, job of multiple people eight. They had to adjust for this in the second half.
And I think Grace made the point, not Grace Robertson, that like Liverpool knew their whole game plan and attack was down the left, but sort of struggled to get it there, especially in the first half. It is interesting. Like, I'm not sure how much I want to, like, invest in them fixing the problems in the second half as opposed to just like Salah going god mode a couple of times. But like when your players are that good, then it's like that's part of the deal.
Yeah, and it's like it struck me that the way that they broke through was not that different from what they were trying to do in the first half with all that possession.
Yeah.
It just worked. And it also struck me that each of the times that they broke through, it's not like City didn't have defenders.
Right. That's sort of the point I'm getting at. It's just that, like, Rodri looked like a guy who hit the tackle button really late playing FIFA. Like that's what Salah does to you.
Yeah. No, the second goal is just stupendous, like, Messi-like,
yeah,
you know, beating several different players and still needing to be perfect on the finish, you know, comes off the inside of the post, like, just crazy stuff. And I don't know how you, it's not like a game plan tactical issue.
Right.
And the first goal is, you know, the thing with the first goal that was really striking to me is that as I was watching it develop, even up to the very final ball, I didn't think it was going to be that good a chance. And Mane managed to let the ball run across him just enough to really be coming directly at Ederson and make it a very difficult chance to save, that I thought he was going to be stuck too wide. And, like, the ball manages to move just enough. He managed to adjust his run just enough and get his body shape just perfect. Like, it took a ton of individual quality to make that into a good scoring chance.
Yeah,
in the very final set of movements.
That's a really good way to put that. I think more broadly, like, looking at this match, these are just two really, really good teams. Like, yes, City kind of could use a creative forward. And yes, Liverpool may be brittle at points on the field as they age. But, like, they're just really good. Like, both of these teams are just really, really good.
I think what made it so much fun is that the second half, you know, Liverpool were able to do enough in attack that City just had to dial it back a little bit. You didn't see big changes. They just had to, like, okay, we can't commit quite as much to going forward. You weren't even committing that much before, but we can't commit quite as much. And so it becomes a much more even 50-50 game with both teams still having, like, both teams have so much quality in attack and so many, like,
good ways to break a team down, that they were able to get forward wall-keeping numbers back. So you get this game that is going up and down and exciting things are happening without that many great chances being conceded because both teams are also, you know, defending very well. Like, it's just also, the quality on both sides.
I want to say, when we say quality on both sides, it's like they also have, like, a lot of quality in defense. So what you have is a lot of, like, it's not that they're focused on defending in a way that they're cramming guys back. It's like the game was balanced just right in a way that allowed attackers to make a lot of almost plays, but defenders to make fantastic, spectacular plays to prevent them, followed by occasionally attackers making great plays to get goals. Right, like, and here I'm sort of thinking of the Rodri tackle on or block on Fabinho late in the game, where Fabinho does absolutely nothing wrong, has half a goal to shoot out, takes a great touch, and Rodri just closes the distance out of nowhere on this set piece and blocks what seemed like a sure goal. And to me, like, that was the balance of the second half. Right, it's not that, like, both teams defended not so much in a way that nullified the other's attack, but in a way that ultimately coped kind of at the last minute, which makes for, like, really good soccer. Like, that's what it comes down to.
Right. And I think that, like, one of the parts of this story is that Manchester City, like, the way that they tilt the field in their favor now, and this is Pep post COVID ball, and they're still doing it, is just with their quality, that they make another team have to fear them, and they have enough numbers back that the other team doesn't want to take risks. Like, Man City have conceded the second fewest completed open play passes against. Only Leeds are ahead of them, which is hilarious. But they have a absolutely middle-of-the-road opposition pass completion percentage. So they don't prevent the other team from passing by pressing. Leeds have by far the lowest opposition pass completion. City do it differently. City do it by holding the ball and being very good in possession and then making other teams, you know, not want to take the kinds of risks that lead to them having extended possession. And Liverpool were able to, in the second half, screw that up just by being good enough at attacking that City had to sit back a little bit more and do less with the ball. City don't have, I don't know if they don't have the capacity, maybe they, I think they could probably try, but they don't have the plan to take possession away from you.
Yeah.
And Liverpool were able to push them back.
One thing to me that's really interesting is there's a growing Rodri trend. Like a growing Rodri adoration trend, looking at him having improved over the last several years. And I'm not here to say he hasn't improved, but one thing that has absolutely happened as part of Rodri looking better on the field is Rodri is less isolated at the base of a midfield on a Manchester City team. And, like, that is a smart thing to do because Rodri is not Fernandinho. And, you know, yeah, he got embarrassed by Salah, but, like, who's... Like, that's, you know, it's Mo Salah. It can happen. In general, I think he's been quite good in this system. But this system is one that protects him a lot more. It protects all of the back line a lot more. It is kind of magic that you can do this and still have really, really high possession totals. And I do wonder, like, why that is. Like, is it just that, like, the rest of the league has been cowed into not taking chances against them? Has the rest of the league not really twigged to the fact that this is what City is doing? Like, I'm at the point now where I wonder with Manchester City if there's another tactical domino to fall in opposition to them. That, like, they have adjusted to the fact that nobody wants to take risks against them, that they can let other teams have the ball because it doesn't lead to other teams getting forward against them because other teams don't want to get forward regardless. And I do wonder now if the next step is that, like, other teams are going to be like, oh, huh, maybe we can get forward a little bit against City and, like, try to play in their half. And, like, that City are, when that happens, not positioned to rip us apart for getting too aggressive. I don't know. Because, like, it seems to me to be unsustainable to play defense the way they're playing and also have, like, extremely high possession totals.
I completely agree. Like, and this sort of fits with that. But one thing that they're doing this year that I think is an improvement is that Bernardo Silva is really playing central midfield.
Yeah.
And, you know, Bernardo Silva is winning the ball at central midfield rates. He is pressuring above central midfield rates. He is, you know, he's doing the things you need to do there in a way that Gundogan was much more, like, present in midfield than stopping the ball in midfield.
Yeah.
And I think that this is an improvement. The lack of Gundogan coming into the penalty area after Foden had broken through on the left was also very clear. But I think that these are the tweaks. But I share your sort of concern or suspicion or something that, like, something's weird here.
Consternation is the word I'm putting on it. Like, consternation. I just don't quite get how it all fits together sustainably.
Yeah, I agree. And so this is what we're going to be talking about more kind of on the subscription side, breaking into, in particular, team statistics. And, you know, we're 7 matches into the season, and we see in Man City this weird thing that other teams don't possess the ball against them, but other teams do complete their passes just fine against them, and City don't press that much. And, like, how does that all fit together? Is this, like, a tactically sustainable system? Here, I think we can see descriptively what is happening. Like, you could, those stats describe the thing we see in Manchester City games. For other teams, like, the stats don't fit together, and my question is, okay, we're 7 games in, we are getting signal in team numbers to a real extent, but which part of it is more likely to be the signal? And we're going to try to piece that together with a few teams, Manchester United, Brentford, a few others, and that will be our podcast. So I have already done the intro to that podcast, so we'll just jump right into it on the subscription side at patreon.com/doublepivot when we get there.
Cheers, y'all.
Cheers.